This podcast is sponsored by liveproducersonline.com, a community of Ableton Live users connecting you to the pros to learn today's music production. What's up, everybody? Welcome to another episode of the Ableton Music Producer Podcast. This is Dan Giffen, like always. Just wanted to give a shout out to today's special guest. I'm really stoked. Her name is Yan Zhu. She's a security researcher and chief information security officer at Brave Software. She's also a talk reviewer for DEF CON, and she was listed as one of the 30 under 30 in enterprise technology by Forbes, which is super cool. I'm stoked to have her on the podcast today. She also produces under the name Azuki, and she's an up-and-coming DJ, producer, hacker on the West Coast bass music scene. She probably knows your password and you don't even know it. She's just a brilliant person, and I actually found her on YouTube doing a series on how to hack Ableton Live using Python scripts. Just crazy good stuff. So I'm stoked to have her on the podcast today. Thank you for listening, everyone. And here is today's episode. Thanks for joining the podcast. I just kind of wanted to get to know you better. And like for the listeners, you might be like definitely in the top two or three most tech savvy people I've had on the podcast. Tell us like a little bit about what you're doing right now. I know you're working with Brave as the chief information security officer. So what does that look like?
Yeah, so I guess, as you said, my day job is software engineering, especially in computer security and privacy. But kind of the side passions I have are making music, DJing, and like generally trying to make people's lives, the musicians' lives easier through technology. And yeah. I kind of think like the last one is kind of where I want to focus this podcast, because I think there's a couple areas where, you know, things could be greatly improved, such as monetization.
For sure.
Yeah. And some of the workflow that people do.
Yeah, so monetization, what do you mean in that sense? Like what type of monetization?
Well, so I think, like as you said, it's really hard to make money from Spotify unless you're a bigger artist, because the amount that people get per stream is really low. And of course, there's alternatives like Bandcamp, where it's more like you pay what you want, or you pay artists directly, and then they get a much larger cut.
Right.
Brave is kind of more in that latter category. So we're a web browser that's focused on privacy and speed. But at the same time, we want to kind of help creators, not just musicians, but just creators of any content that goes on the web, to help them make more money.
So, right on. And crypto is part of that too, right? I mean...
Yeah, I would say that's definitely part of it. A lot of people know us as like the cryptocurrency browser, although that's not how I think of it. I think of us more as like a browser that's trying to generate more revenues for creators instead of through like the traditional ads revenue model.
Yeah. Right. Sure. Well, like I know that you've done a lot like inside the music realm as well. I mean, you've collabed with Mr. Bill, as we were talking about, been wanting to have him on this podcast for a while, and you recently went on a tour with him. And if the listeners, if you've never heard of Mr. Bill, shame on you. You should go check him out. He makes really dope video tutorials in Ableton Live as well.
Yeah.
And that's actually how we connected, is I saw you made a video on how to hack an Ableton Live set and throw it into Rekordbox using a script with a software called Python, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, honestly, I have not been doing stuff in music for very long, like maybe since 2017 or 18. So really? I consider myself like a huge noob in this world. Mainly part of what I've been focusing on in the last 6 months or so is just figuring out ways to use programming to make the music workflow easier for people, including myself. But I try to give away all the tools I make for free, so anyone can use them.
Yeah. Well, this is like, music's not new for you. Like, you grew up playing, was it flute? Like,
you were piccolo,
a flutist or a flautist or whatever.
Flautist, I guess.
Yeah. The flautist. So, like, yeah, tell us about your musical background. I'd like to also talk about how that translate into using technology in the music you're doing now.
Right. So, I started out playing, actually, it was really interesting, because like a lot of Asian kids, like their parents are like, you have to learn piano when you're 3 years old and violin and stuff. But my parents were the opposite. They were like, oh, just like, don't do music stuff because you can't get a job doing it. So So I started, playing flute when I was in middle school. And then around high school, I got really into like classical and jazz composition. So I wrote like a really short wind symphony and like a bunch of orchestral stuff. And that was using Finale, which is a scoring software that a lot of people in classical music use. But I don't think anyone uses that for electronic music.
No. Oh, you probably could. You could probably hack Finale and make it cool if you wanted to.
Yeah, I mean, I think people mainly use it because it has these really good like MIDI sound libraries. So if you're making like an orchestra score, you can get like a trombone that really sounds like a trombone.
Yeah.
And such. So
there's a company that makes really good expressive instruments. I think it's called SWAM. SWAM. They make a lot of really expressive like instruments. Like they have a saxophone plugin that's really awesome.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it sounds pretty legit. You can use
this as like a VST.
Yeah, totally. Oh, yeah, it's pretty nice. Yeah. Even if like you're using like one of those wind instruments, like wind MIDI controllers.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm talking about? I'm trying to think of the proper name.
Oh yeah, I've seen these. It's like a MIDI of like flute recorder.
Yeah. It works really great with those. A lot of people that use those MIDI wind instruments are actually using SWAM too. Sounds really great with those.
That's really cool.
But yeah, so like you grew up like doing classical stuff and now you obviously, this is the Ableton Live podcast. You're using Ableton to do some of your producing.
Yeah. Only Ableton. I don't use anything else anymore.
Yeah, right. For good reasons. How did you start getting into Ableton Live? Like, when did that start for you and what made you jump into that?
I actually first heard of Ableton maybe around 2011 when I had some friends in college who were really into electronic music and they were doing like more experimental stuff, not like EDM. And they were talking about it. And I first got my hands on it because I bought a MIDI keyboard and it just came with, you know, that free trial version of Ableton, which I actually made several tunes in before upgrading. So
nice.
Yeah, you can get pretty far with just the trial.
Yeah. I went from Cubase into Ableton Live and very different, very different. And it took me like a whole day to figure out how to get sound out of Live. It was like super confusing. I was like, what is this monster I'm playing with?
Man. But, Ableton has all these things that has like, it has such a weirdly big learning curve in some ways.
Mm-hmm.
But one thing that I like, that reminded me, like when I was learning Ableton, I didn't know how to use automation for like a good 6 months. Because I just didn't read the manual and I was like, oh, how do I make it get louder or quieter? I'll just like copy it into a new clip, which is like louder.
Right.
Let's do that.
Right. So, that's funny. Your music's like really cool too. It's, I guess in my own words, I would call it like experimental is a bad word. I feel like experimental gets a bad like connotation to it, but it's like experimental based music. And it's just really like interesting textures. It definitely has, like a kind of a darker, more ambient dance bass kind of vibe. And I really dig it. I've been getting into more of that kind of stuff lately.
That's so awesome.
Really tight. So you perform live, you've played at a couple different festivals. You played at Priceless Festival. I actually looked it up. I've never heard of it until recently.
It's tiny. It's a really, really small festival.
Yeah. Sometimes those are the best ones though. Like, playing smaller shows oftentimes are sometimes my favorite. It's that intimacy with the audience and you create like a small experience and meet people that way.
Yeah, I would say Priceless is kind of interesting in that it's been going on for like 10 plus years as far as I know. And it's always been so small, like less than 1,000 people-ish for most of its history. And there's three stages, so and each of the stages is also really small. Like even when it's like fully packed, there's only 100 people there.
Yeah.
So it's often confusing the artists when they get there because they're like, oh, like how is this like such a small festival? But it's like somehow if it works out financially and it happens every year.
Nice.
Yeah.
And where are you currently living right now? Where are you based?
I'm in San Francisco.
Right on. Yeah. That's cool. Yeah. I'll be in Pasadena next week for the Ableton certification, actually.
Taking the exam for that?
Going through the two-day testing of all that good stuff. But I love the West Coast. It's beautiful.
Yeah.
San Francisco is no exception. It's awesome. Yeah, so what does your live performance look like? I mean, you played this show, and I know you did, you created a custom script for the APC 40.
Yeah.
Can you talk about like what inspired that, like what made that and what you're using it for?
Sure. So my live setup right now is really boring. It's just, if I'm DJing, it's mainly I just use CDJs because it's easy. And like, you just, all you have to do is carry a USB stick.
That's nice.
I have been doing more like set preparation in Ableton, like making edits of things and then copying that in a record box. But yeah, so I guess I switched from DJing in Ableton, which is what I did for like my first year of DJing, into using record box and CDJs this past summer. And that's actually what inspired me to make the script that converts Ableton cues into record box cues. Because I had like hundreds of tracks and I wanted to move them all to record box, but like all my cue points were in Ableton. So I actually did this by hand and it took a couple weeks, but later I realized like, you know, with some basic programming, you can just write a script to do it in like a few seconds. So
that's awesome. That's a whole new world, like outside of my scope of technology. So when I saw that tutorial video, I was like, this is really dope. Like I want this script. So I need to play with it. But I thought that was really valuable, especially for that convenience of like, instead of carrying your laptop and a bunch of MIDI controllers, if you can just carry a flash drive, it's a lot easier. But oftentimes, you know, you set up a lot of your live performance or you have all of your music in Ableton, and it's just easy if you can actually convert all that into record box. For those who don't know what record box is, if you're listening and you're not sure, that's it's like a DJing software where you prepare your live sets, and then you can just import that with a flash drive into pretty much any CDJ. And yeah, it's a lot of DJs are using that, and that's kind of the go-to main software these days.
Yeah, and I've seen a lot of people where you know, they'll use CDJs, like Bill does this, he'll use CDJs if he's playing a back-to-back set with someone. Like he has this collab project called Mr. Bill Gates with Ill Gates.
Yeah,
and so like I guess you can technically do a back-to-back set in Ableton if you use like the Ableton, I think it's called Link or something.
Yeah.
Never actually used it.
Yeah, totally.
But yeah, people don't, for some reason, like don't really perform doing that. Like they prefer CDJs. So.
For sure. Yeah, it's the convenience. It was funny. I remember I showed up a pretty popular up-and-coming club in Indianapolis. Like I was the only person that showed up with a laptop because I didn't know how to use CDJs very well at all. And so they're like, what are you doing? And I was like, yeah, this is how I'm playing. I'm using my APC 40 and a laptop. And they're just like, well, what do we plug you into? Like they were all confused. I was like, really? Like, this is a thing? Really?
Yeah.
And so we just plugged into the mixer. And like, you know, oftentimes back-to-back sets, like you were saying, it's a matter of just fading out of one set straight into the other. You don't want to actually stop the vibe. You don't want the music to stop. And so that was like there, I had to like basically go buy an aux cable to RCA. So like before the show, just so I could like plug into the mixer of the CDJ and have that happen.
Yeah. Yeah. For anyone out there listening, who's primarily DJing in Ableton, it is just my opinion that like, it's really helpful to learn CDJs just because at some point you might get booked at a club where like they don't really want you to bring your own laptop and have like a fancier setup. And
take it from me. It's true. It's very, very true. Yeah. So, I mean, you've had a lot of other accomplishments outside of music as well. And the technical world, I think, is really cool. You were listed as one of the 30 under 30 in enterprise technology by Forbes magazine. That's pretty dope.
It sounds dope, but it's actually kind of dumb because like, like everyone thinks, I don't know, like whenever I put that on some biography, like everyone points that out, but like, it's just called 30 under 30, but there's like 20 or 30 categories. So it's actually like 600 under 30. So if you say it that way, like I was one of the 600 under 30, that's like doesn't sound as cool.
But when you're talking about like billions of people in the world, like that's still pretty cool. Like, technology.
Yeah, I guess it's like biased too towards people who like know someone who works at Forbes.
You know, that's true in every industry.
Yeah, that's true. Like I've heard that's the thing for like DJ, like top 100 lists as well. It's just like, who do you know who makes the list?
Oh, I'm amazed, but I still go to festivals and I hear like music that sounds terrible, and it's just because some guy probably knew some festival booking manager, and it was like, dude, your music's not that great. Like, I don't know how you're playing. You just doesn't even know how to DJ. But I mean, a lot of time it is what you know or who you know.
Yeah.
But so you said you played with Mr. Bill, or you did a tour with him. What was that like?
That was my first touring experience, and Bill says it wasn't even like a real tour. It was just like a light tour because we just had a show once per week, pretty much for like 3 weeks. And it wasn't I don't know, but I feel like a real tour, like, well, from what I've heard, is people doing shows like 4 days or three days a week. I don't know. But it was cool, I guess. It was in Australia, which is like a place I'd never been before. So it's kind of tricky as a DJ to be like, what kinds of music do people like? And like, how do I read them? Like, do they react the same way as crowds in San Francisco or differently? And I would say like the main difference was people really, really like psytrance there.
Psytrance, okay.
Yeah, which seems to be like a very country-specific thing. Like Bill says, like Israel, Brazil, and Australia, people are just like crazy for that genre. But like in the US, it doesn't really seem to be a thing.
Yeah. So. It's interesting. I see a lot of these genres, like it, like certain parts in certain countries, it'll be like late adopters. Like psytrance, who knows, like on the West Coast might be freaking huge in like a couple of years. You know, it might just take a while to get there.
Yeah, maybe. I feel like we had our chance already, given that it's like been around for a while.
Yeah, especially in electronic music, in my own personal experience, and I might be way off, so don't judge me, whoever's listening to this, but I see a lot of times Europe, typically, there's like a trend within like mainstream electronic music. A lot of what becomes popular in Europe, usually half a decade later, starts to translate into the States. Just from what I've seen. I mean, I saw that with like drum and bass like 10 years ago. I feel like drum and bass was like big in Europe, and then it started translating over to the US and started becoming more popular in certain states. I see that a lot with like different parts of the world. Mm. Starts filtering out and takes a while to get to other places.
Interesting.
Yeah. So another thing I saw in your bio, I thought it was pretty funny. It was pretty cool. Is like you ended up dropping out of high school. And then soon after ended up completing a bachelor's of science in physics from MIT. How does that happen? Can you explain that?
Yeah, I mean, again, it's like one of those things that sounds cooler when you say it, but mainly it was just, I went to like a really shitty high school, and I went to like a public school in St. Louis, and I just wasn't learning anything. So I applied and got into college early. Yeah, college was a much better experience.
Yeah, it sounds like it. I mean, yeah. MIT isn't any joke. That's a pretty legit place.
Yeah, but like I rarely use anything I learned there anymore. I feel like it was a pure physics degree, and like no one. It's pretty rare that you like have to use physics outside of like research.
So. Yeah, that might be true, maybe, but not a lot of people get into MIT in the first place. So. I think you're just being really humble.
I don't know. It doesn't feel like that cool to me. I think there's people doing cooler stuff. Like when I see someone who's like a 15-year-old like music producer who's made like all these awesome tracks, I'm like, oh, that's way cooler.
Yeah.
But I think there's a bias there in that like whatever, you know, you do, like you might think it's like easier than what other people do.
Yeah. One of my favorite quotes that I've heard is comparison kills creativity.
So, yeah,
like, for me, true. I have to fight that a lot. Is like if I'm comparing myself to somebody else all the time, there's always going to be somebody that's better at something than I am. Doesn't matter what I do, you know.
But maybe it can go the other way too. Like if you see someone who's like popular, who you're like, oh, I could make that kind of music, then maybe that'll like motivate you to make.
For
that.
Sure. Yeah. No. Totally. There's a lot of people out there making crap. That's also true. It's very, very true. As far as like future music projects that you have in the works, like what are you working on now? Like what's the long-term vision? Your artist name is Asuki. How did you come up with that? Your like image is a rabbit.
Yeah.
That is great. And actually your Instagram bio says, I'm famous on Twitter for hacker stuff, but this account is mostly music and rabbits, which I love that.
Yeah, it's a pretty... I think as far as like music projects go, mine was started extremely arbitrarily. A lot of people spend like, you know, a long time trying to figure out my DJ name. And for me, it was like, I just was on SoundCloud looking for usernames that weren't taken. Cause one of my constraints was I want my artist name to just be like the same as my SoundCloud URL name. And I tried like a million different words, and finally Azuki was not taken, and it's the name of my rabbit.
Oh, nice.
So, I have a pet rabbit.
Yeah. Okay. That's cool. Yeah. What kind of rabbit is he? Is he like a white rabbit, black rabbit?
He's like a small, like not very friendly black rabbit.
He's a mean black rabbit.
Yeah, exactly. But he's very small.
Okay. That's cool. Yeah. You should like sample him in a track or something.
See, that's the thing. Everyone says that, but he doesn't make any sounds. Like, because rabbits are prey animals, and so
yeah,
that's
true.
They try to be very quiet. No.
Squeak or anything? No squeaking?
No. Okay. I mean, the most sound he makes, which I actually did record once, was him drinking water, because he like licks it and it makes like a splashy noise, but it's not very distinctive. Yeah.
Put that in a drum rack and maybe some drum or something.
Yeah, some OTT.
There you go. Very loud. A lot of OTTs.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah, and as far as projects go, right now I'm actually focusing a little bit more on Max for Live. Okay. That is a technology that I've tried to not learn for the longest time, because Max is this visual programming language.
Sure.
I think for a lot of people who come from, you know, like traditional text-based programming, mm-hmm. We look at it and we're like, oh, this is all visual and you have to like click things. That doesn't seem very efficient or fun to do. So for the last few years I was like, I'm not gonna even like bother to learn Max. But recently I found out you can just write this programming language called JavaScript, mm-hmm. In it, which I know pretty well. So I did some of that.
Okay, so I didn't know you could run JavaScript inside Max.
You can, yeah. There's so like everything in the live object model you can access from JavaScript using Max.
Very cool.
Which is pretty cool. Yeah.
I just started diving into Max for Live. For anybody who's not super familiar, because there's a lot of people all different experience levels listening, Max for Live, like you said, is a visual programming language, which eventually was created originally by a company called Cycling 74 that mm-hmm. ended up becoming Ableton ended up partnering with them. And with the release of Ableton Live 10, now it comes bundled inside of Live Suite. And so it's included when you install Ableton Live, and it just allows you to create like your own custom effects and instruments and all types of different things to be able to have whatever end result you want to hack Ableton or to do different things. That was one of the questions I was going to ask you, is how much have you done with Max for Live? I just started really getting into it recently.
Yeah, same. I only started getting into it.
Yeah. It's funny that you say that, like, you like the more text-based programming, because mm-hmm. for me, I like the simple, easy drag and drop objects that it has for you. Makes it easy for people like me who don't know anything about Java or text-based mm-hmm. anything.
Yeah, I have this problem. I have like the exact opposite problem that a lot of music people have. So I've talked to a lot of people who have seen these scripts I've written, and basically their question is like, how do I run this? Because there's no like easy drag and drop interface for like running a Python script. And so like I've been told, like, if you want anyone to be able to run this, you have to just like make it into a package or like make it into a VST where someone can just like click it and it runs. Yeah. But yeah, I actually like have a lot of trouble with like drag and drop interfaces. Like, I don't find them intuitive.
Yeah.
And I have the same issue with YouTube videos. Like, I've noticed every like music tutorial is a YouTube video, and for me, I just like learn much better if it's written down as text.
Okay. So, yeah. That's interesting.
Yeah, I don't know.
So have you ever considered dabbling into the world of actually programming VSTs or like audio plugins?
Yeah, so I've done a little VST programming, but I haven't really enjoyed it. I think there's a couple of things that are kind of annoying with it. One is that you have to use this language called C++, which I don't know super well personally, and mm-hmm. is kind of an annoying language to work with. And also you have to, so when you make a VST, it has to run on like both Mac and Windows usually. If you want to like mm-hmm. sell it to the largest number of people, you definitely want to get it running on at least those two platforms.
Sure.
And so I use a Mac. And so if I wrote a VST, I'd have to like get a Windows VM or like get a Windows machine and test it there.
Yeah.
And like that burden, I was just like,
just send it to Mr. Bill and be like, yo, does this work?
Yeah, exactly.
Make him fix it.
Yeah, but I actually like Max, like having dug a little bit into Max, I like it a lot. I guess you can't run it in like other DAWs, but mm-hmm. I think at least in Ableton, like it works pretty well. It's easier to program and it's like works across all operating systems.
For sure. And it's very like shareable. You know, you could easily mm-hmm. share it with anybody who's running Ableton Live that has Max installed. They can mm-hmm. just pull it up super easy and install it. It's very shareable. MaxForLive.com. You could be like the next hottest user on there, just uploading all kinds of cool stuff.
Yeah, I made a couple one really simple Max patch last night, but I don't even know if it's worth uploading. Like maybe people can give me feedback on it.
Hey, do it. Honestly.
But basically, yeah. It's just this, you know how sometimes when you're doing stuff in MIDI, you want it to be an audio. Okay. So there's like mainly two ways people do that. They either like freeze the MIDI track and then like drag that into an audio track, or they like resample it into audio and then work with the audio. I just made a simple Max plugin that like you just click one button and it does that.
Okay.
Makes it a little bit faster.
So does it replace the current track as if you were freezing and flattening, or does it create a new track?
It creates a new track because I think sometimes people like don't want to lose the original MIDI, but
nice.
Yeah, I think it could just replace the original.
Okay, nice. So rather than having to like duplicate the track, freeze and flatten, it's just you just hit a Max for Live button on the device and it just automatically does that for you?
Pretty much, yeah.
That's cool. You should send it to me. I'll play with it.
All right.
Yeah, just don't put a virus in it, because I feel like you're smart enough where you could like hack my computer right now without me knowing.
And so I actually like read a bunch about this morning, because Max, I was just like wondering, like, what is it capable of? Could you like make a virus in Max?
Right.
And, yeah, you totally can. Like,
yeah.
You basically have everything. So like every time you load an untrusted Max patch from some random website, it's you could definitely get a virus that way.
Yeah, I was talking to my friend actually earlier today about that. He works in IT and he was talking to me about that. And there was one Max for Live device where you open it and it automatically searches, it does a Google search for cute puppies. And it'll just like, so the moment you run it, it just like searches for cute puppies on YouTube and on Google. And just,
does like, it show it to you in Ableton or something?
No, it just opens your browser and just does it right there, which is kind of funny. So yeah, I guess there's like endless possibilities.
Yeah, I think someone wrote a Max patch that just like restarts your computer or something.
You could totally mess with people. You could have a lot of fun with this. You could be doing all kinds of stuff. You could make people... You could just like do a Max patch that goes straight to your Spotify and just like automatically hits follow or something and just market it as something else.
Be like, yeah, just like hide like a follow button.
Yeah, it'd be a good idea. Cool. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think we're onto something here.
Yeah. I'm actually surprised more people don't do this who like make Max patches or even VSTs. I think you could do all of these things in like a VST as well.
Yeah. I think most Max for Live developers are white hat type of people.
Doing good
for the community of music. Yeah. So yeah, I guess like with your approach for producing music with all this like tech background that you have, would you say that like your approach to starting a song is different with that technical mindset?
No, it's absolutely not. I guess like I think the creativity, like the creative process and this like technical stuff, like tooling and workflow work that I do are like completely separate, like halves of the brain or something, because like a lot of people I talk to who are programmers who are also musicians say that like one of the best ways to not get any music writing done is to just like work on these programming side projects all the time. I would say like it's more distracting than anything from like the creative flow process.
I can see that.
Yeah. And I don't think my music starting process is different from anyone else's. Like mainly I just open Ableton and like make a bunch of sounds and then cut them up.
Yeah.
Try to find something that sounds good.
Right.
But actually I was talking to Bill recently about some ways that you could make plugins to help people generate ideas. Because a lot of his process is just like, well, I think a lot of people do this. They just like randomly arrange stuff and like try putting in stuff and see what sounds good. So we had an idea to make a plugin that just like randomizes a bunch of parameters. And then you can just click that a bunch of times and be like, oh, okay, that one sounds kind of cool. I'll keep that.
Yeah, that sounds pretty dope. It sounds familiar to a new Max for Live device that was just released. Huh. The guy's name, I'm drawing a blank. He's actually going to be on the podcast pretty soon, but he created something called Factor Synth. Have you seen this?
No.
Yeah, so it's like a randomizer for remixing a song. So you can drop in like an audio file. It'll chop it up into a bunch of different pieces, and then you can select the certain pieces that you want. Like it'll extract, like say, the vocal part of that song or whatever else. It'll pull it out, and then it'll chop it up for you and just generate random ideas. And you could select those and drag them in as like MIDI clips and continue to work on them.
Wow, that's super interesting.
It's really interesting. Yeah, you should definitely check it out. It's called Factor Synth. And yeah, it's brand new. It came out not that long ago. It's kind of a similar idea of just randomizing audio and then playing it back.
Nice. Yeah, I see. It says it uses machine learning, which is...
Right.
Very fancy.
Right. Yeah. This guy's pretty next level. Have you experimented much with like machine learning at all? I know that's a whole different rabbit hole.
No, not really. I guess if you count just like any kind of data mining as machine learning, then like broadly I have done stuff with it, but I haven't done like neural networks and things like that.
Mm-hmm. So. What are some of your favorite go-to plugins that you use for producing?
Oh, plugins. Let's see. I use Serum like everyone else.
Yep. Yeah, it's a given for anybody in electronic music.
Recently, like Bill has shown, gotten me into Soothe, which I think
I'm familiar with that.
Oh, it's really cool. So it basically like, I guess maybe you would call this dynamic EQing, where you put it on a sound and it looks for like the highest frequency peaks in the sound, and then makes them flatter. So it makes your overall sound like smoother and like flatter sounding.
Yes, I have seen this. I was talking to a guy named Kermode recently, and he was mentioning this company.
Yeah.
Right on.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
Who's the company that makes this?
It's called Oek Sound, I think. Oek Sound.
Yep, this is one of their plugins. Right on. Yeah, I've seen this interface before. It looks pretty. It's just nice to look at, honestly.
Yeah.
Some plugins are really ugly and it's uninspiring. If you look at a plugin and it's pretty to look at, I feel like it naturally just sounds better to you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like visuals. People like eyes feed a lot into like what they hear. Yeah.
This is true. I have to remind myself of that when mixing. Like close my eyes sometimes and actually like just focus on my ears rather than my eyes.
Mm-hmm. Another thing that I found out about recently that's really cool is TruFi. So it's not a VST, it's more like a operating system application. So basically it takes whatever is going into your output and then EQs it, so it's more closer to like a reference curve. So let's say you have like some really cheap earbuds or headphones like the ones I'm wearing now. So those usually aren't very flat, like they have like weird peaks and stuff, just because they're using like really cheap hardware. So TruFi takes those peaks and kind of like cancels them out using an EQ curve. So then they sound flatter. Yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
So you would just run that like for the output on like the master or something, and it would just do that for your headphones.
Yeah, pretty much. You wouldn't even do it on master. You would just run it like for your entire operating system. So like anything coming out of your sound card would be like EQ'd. Way.
So in the sense of like installing something like Soundflower, you would just install this and it would just be your output.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay.
Exactly.
Very cool.
And I thought this was a cool idea because like a lot of people, especially like non-producers, like use really crappy headphones and they're probably not even aware that like their headphones are adding these like weird peaks and such in the frequency spectrum. Yeah. So like what if Apple computers just came with this software? So like it could make your headphones all sound better.
That's a really interesting idea. Yeah. There's nothing more tragic than people like mixing their final mix downs on Beat headphones or something. Beats is like, dude, that's not accurate at all. Like you're going to have your mixes are going to be crazy bass heavy and it's just going to be sad.
Yeah, but also if you think about like what most people listen to music on, it's probably like really cheap, like fairly standard cheap headphones,
right,
or like
right.
computer speakers or like phone speakers, which are even worse.
Totally.
So like that's what they hear all the time.
Right. No, I mean that, you know, that's a fair point too, is like referencing is everything, like multiple references. Yeah. Cause if it's, you have to, and that's the last thing I listen on is my iPhone. If it sounds okay on my iPhone after it's passed all my other speakers and everything, then it's a good day.
Yeah.
For sure. What about Ableton Live devices as far as like stock Ableton plugins? What are some of your favorite toys?
lately I've been using OTT a lot.
Yeah.
It's a good one. There's this new granulator thing called Grain Scanner. Okay. I don't think it's a stock device. I think you have to get it somehow, but it's
like a pack or something.
Yeah, it's like a really cool grain thing.
Yeah, the granulator is a Max for Live device that came out a while ago.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was the Granulator 2 that came out, I think, several years ago. Is that what you're talking about? The Granulator?
No, this is even newer than that. Yeah, it's like a
it's just called Grain?
Grain Scanner.
Grain Scanner. I'm going to check that
out. Yeah, it's like a really nice interface. Oh, yeah, it's just on the Ableton packs page. So.
Okay, right on. Yeah, I've got some homework to do. This is good. I love it.
Yeah.
So when is your next single coming out?
Oh man, I have a few that are maybe ready. So there's one that's a remix for someone, and this is actually like my first time doing like an official remix, and it's not out yet because they can't figure out how to release it. So kind of stuck, but I'm hoping that'll be like sometime in the next month or so. Yeah.
I'm a fan of CD Baby or DistroKid when it comes to getting that stuff out there. But remixes can be weird and tricky when it comes to actually officially releasing a remix, unless you have permission from the actual original artist.
Yeah, well, this is like the artist hit me up being like, okay, can you make a remix? So it's definitely official. It's just like they haven't quite figured out what their whole release plan is. So
yeah. Well, like, I know that you are at work right now, so I don't want to like keep you away from your job. But as far as like the future of, I guess, like music technology, if you had to make a couple like predictions, like in the future of what that's going to look like from a programming perspective, like what's next? Like, what is the future?
Oh, that's a really, really good question. One thing that I saw recently that I think could, it's not quite at the level where like producers are using it, but I think it would be in like the next year or a couple years, is software for automatically generating stems from a song. There's a proof of concept called Spleeter, I think, S-P-L-E-E-T-E-R. And right now it's just this like program that runs, you feed it a song as input, like a rendered WAV file or whatever, and it'll split that into a bunch of stems. For instance, you can specify like 4 stems. I want like a bass, drums, vocals, and everything else.
Okay.
And it actually is pretty good. So like, if you currently want vocals, let's say you're doing like a remix and you want just the vocal track and the artist hasn't released an acapella, then what a lot of people do is just try to like EQ out all the like lows, but that obviously doesn't sound very good. Like you get tons of leakage from like hi-hats and other things.
Yeah.
And so this gives you like a much, much cleaner vocal line.
Okay.
For working with. So
that's interesting. So can you select the type of instrument you want to extract from it in the song?
I don't think it's that precise yet. So I think right now it only has a few options. One that's like vocals and everything else, and one that's like vocals, drums, bass, and everything else.
Interesting.
But yeah, I think like as machine learning gets better at this kind of sound processing, like in the future, maybe you can say like, I just want this one instrument stemmed
out. Yeah, no, that's really interesting and fascinating. I'd be curious to play with that. Are you familiar? There's a very similar thing that came out by iZotope called Music Rebalance.
I have not heard of that.
Yeah, it's actually doing that right now. And it works okay. It's called Music Rebalance. It's a part of the iZotope's RX7 bundle. Mm-hmm. It works okay. It's actually not too bad. They came out with it, I want to say like 2 years ago or so, almost, not even. But it only lets you, I believe, extract vocals, bass, percussion, and then other, whatever other is.
Yeah, it sounds pretty similar then.
Yeah, I've played with it and it works okay. I found that the bass and like the drums, especially the kick drum, sometimes bleed over a little bit, but it actually works not bad.
Nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, I should check that out and see how well that works compared to this other thing. But the cool thing about this other thing, Spleeter, is that it's, as far as I know, it's all open source. So
nice.
If someone's a developer, they can just use that code and put it into their own applications. And whereas the Isotope, like all of Isotope stuff, as far as I know, is closed source. So
yeah,
they don't
sure.
like release any of their algorithms for doing this stuff.
No, they don't. They keep that on pretty tight lock.
Yeah, it's like how they make money. But
exactly, yeah. But they make great stuff.
Yeah.
That. Those guys know what they're doing. Yeah. No, I totally agree. I think machine learning is something that is going to continue to develop in the music world. I'm really curious to see what that looks like as well, as far as being able to be like, here's my idea, make something cool for me. And just computer just goes in and is like, and just does something for you and makes it like cool. I don't know. That'll be interesting. And then there's the question of is like, are you still being creative with like that possibility? You know, like if machines are making music for us, you know, are we using that as like a means to continue producing, or are people just going to like let computers make music for us and then we just release it and call it our own? You know, that could be a real thing in the future. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. We're definitely we're pretty far off from that. Like I haven't seen any, I don't know. I haven't really looked for any, but I haven't seen great demos of, you know, completely computer generated music where I'm like, oh, that sounds like a human could have made it.
Right. Yeah. So, maybe. Not yet anyway. Who knows?
Yeah. My guess is like it'll be one of those things where computers generate like the seed of an idea and then like people turn that into something interesting.
Yeah.
In the near future. And I don't think that's cheating. I think that's like about as much cheating as like starting with someone else's sample is, you know, when you're someone else's presets. But now instead of like getting a preset from Splice, it's just like a preset that's generated by machine learning on your computer.
Right.
Or something like that.
I think it's that balance of like, am I using this as the end result or am I using this to be creative with? Mm-hmm. You know, am I making something out of something that's already existed or am I just like taking a 4-bar loop and calling it my own and just leaving it as it is? You know, mm-hmm. I think there's that fine line, that balance. But
I don't know, like I think I agree with you on that too, but I'm always surprised to like learn about, you know, these huge songs where they just completely took a 4-bar loop from some other artist. And then like I think a lot of Daft Punk songs have this thing where like they found that like they basically just copied a riff exactly from like an old blues tune or something.
It happens all the time, honestly. I've done the same thing. I'm guilty of that. Like I was listening to the Discover Weekly playlist on Spotify and I heard like one of the main loops that I used in Splice on another guy's track and I'm like, that's my song. I like sent him a message on Instagram and he's like, yo, that's dope, we should be friends.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it was funny.
Yeah, that's one thing that I think is different from like music and programming is like in programming when you like use other people's code, it's like not seen as bad at all. It's like, oh, like you used it and it worked and like you did something with it, that's great.
Yeah,
it's not like stealing, it's just like how the whole field moves forward is by like copying and pasting other people's code.
That's true. Yeah, that's true. It's like there's that one funny meme, I don't know if you've seen it, where it's like talking about how like I started using samples and I thought that was cheating. And so then I started like, and it like goes all the way through this long process of eventually he's like, so I started like making my own drums and then like skinning sheep to make my own drums. And I had to get a farm and it's like, it just goes bad. But
yeah, I think I saw that on Reddit a while ago.
It's hilarious. It's funny. At some point you just have to start making music, whether you're using samples or not. But
yeah.
Well, yeah, no, I'm stoked to hear more of the stuff that you release in the future. And I'm excited to have you on the podcast. And I encourage everybody to check out your tracks, Azuki. I'll include links in the show notes. So if you guys are listening right now, go check out her stuff. It's super dope. And yeah, I look forward to hearing more from you. And where's the best place for people to connect with you as far as following you online?
I use Twitter the most actively because that's kind of the account I've had the longest for like hacking stuff and software. So Twitter, My Twitter user handle is bcrypt, B-C-R-Y-P-T.
Bcrypt. Is there like a Patreon for like crypto out there? Like people who can like support you with cryptocurrency? Is that a thing? Like,
that's not something I solicit. Yeah, I kind of don't.
I'm just thinking like
oh, you're saying like, is there a service where you can like, do Patreon? I guess Brave is sort of like that. So I
Brave?
If you download Brave browser from brave.com, you can tip pretty much any creator online in cryptocurrency.
Cool. Right on. Yeah, we'll include a link in the show notes for that too. So I haven't really used Brave, but I'm about to go use it right now and play with it.
Yeah, it's pretty sweet. Like I said earlier, for some reason this podcast link did not work in Chrome, but it worked in Brave.
Yeah, there you go. It's a sign. Weird. Should be using that more often. Right on. Well, thank you. Thank you, Jan, for sure. And good luck with the music and everything and Brave. And hopefully we'll send some more people your way from this podcast.
Cool. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, for sure. This podcast is sponsored by liveproducersonline.com, a community of Ableton Live users connecting you to the pros to learn today's music production.